Okay, I think we are there
Okay.
almost. All right, here we go. Good afternoon, everybody. It is Angie Atkinson, and I'm here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar. Dana, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here as always.
Always happy to have you. For those of you who are new around here, Dana and I do this stream usually every week, and eventually I'm going to find my. There it goes. Okay. I couldn't find the pause button, so I couldn't hear myself. Dana and I do this stream every week, usually on Tuesdays here, and then on her channel back in alternating channels. So if you're it, usually we go around 12:30 Central Time. Today we're a little bit late, my fault. But if you do go and sign up and subscribe and hit the bell notification on both channels, you will be notified when we go live. And you can also text Angie Live, all one word, to 33222, and I will send you a text message 5 minutes before we go live each day. All right. Hello, Martha. So today we are going to talk about narcissistic mothers. And we're going to start off with a question that I received from a viewer, which is, are you ready?
Okay, go for it,
All right. Do you have advice on how to deal with a narcissistic mother with dementia? They are just more evil than before, is the question. So let's talk about it.
yeah. Okay.
All right. So do you have thoughts that you want to start off with, or do you want me to start off?
Either way is fine.
Okay. Go ahead. I'll let you start.
Okay. I guess I would just encourage you and try to validate you with the fact that it's okay to have boundaries. It's appropriate to have boundaries. And it's even more so the case when we have a family member who has some sort of mental illness or personality disorder, or cognitive disorder, because it can just be really, really challenging. And it's very easy to just give and give and give and give and give. And it kind of when it's all said and done, there's nothing left in your own family with your spouse or with your children is destroyed by it. So it's in these times where I know that might seem kind of counterintuitive. A lot of people are probably going to say, oh, well, but she's your mother and she has dementia or, so this is a time to have, to lower your boundaries or to be more, even more flexible with boundaries. I disagree with that because you need, you, it's, reasonable and appropriate to have boundaries and but I think because there also is that added level of dementia there, you might find that it can be a little bit easier to not take her behavior so personally because behavior changes and dementia do go hand in hand. So kind of realizing, yeah, okay, you know what, mom's always been difficult and defiant or what have you, but now, especially, you realize there's cognitive challenges at play, and I don't need to take all this on personally. And you can't, it's too much. You can't fix it. You can't solve it. You can only kind of know your limits and then ask for help from other people. And I would do the same thing. I lived with my grandmother who had dementia. I'm a former nurse. It's okay. People, I see this all the time. People are like, oh, my loved one has cancer or some sort of terminal illness, and they want to, or dementia or something. They want to move them in. And they're like, okay, well, I'm going to be their caregiver 24 hours a day because I should do this because they're family. But even those of us that are trained in that, it's too much. So it's this is why it's important to have your own boundaries. And Angie, what do you think about all this?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with everything you said. And as a non for someone who's never been a nurse, I appreciate your take on this in that way, especially. I think it's important to recognize, I don't know if it's important, but I think it might help to recognize that as a narcissist, the feeling that must come with dementia of feeling like you're out of control, like you're damaged or flawed, seems like it would be especially painful for them. And as we all know, narcissists have a tendency to take out their anger, their frustration, their disappointment, any negative emotion on the closest sources of supply, which of course could be one of their adult children in this case, or in any case. And so I think because it's kind of a progressive disorder, and I think because I think there will certainly, like you said, it gets very difficult for the caregiver. I mean, there are entire support forms for just caregivers of like Alzheimer's patients in general, not to mention elderly parents and et cetera. But I think when we're talking about someone who is already prone to or likely to dump their emotional garbage on you, and then we look at someone, that same person having the cognitive decline, having the lack of inability to remember things, and you see a lot of anger in any, not any, but it could potentially affect any Alzheimer's patient because nobody wants to feel like that. Nobody wants to not remember things or, you know, and as the progression goes, it gets worse. But I think what I've seen a lot is at the beginning, a lot of people don't recognize that they're going through dementia or they're moving toward dementia. They just think that everybody else is crazy around them, which, as we all know, tends to be another thing that your average narcissist is famous for, blaming other people, not taking responsibility. And while I don't think that dementia or Alzheimer's or anything like that is any sort of punishment, I think it's just an unfortunate genetic thing for the most part, although studies have been done to indicate lots of other things might be the cause of it. I think what it comes down to is the process is painful for anyone who goes through it, and a narcissist who is feeling taken by it or overwhelmed by it or insecure about their own abilities. I mean, even as, you know, at my age, I'm 45, I'm not dementia, I don't have dementia at this point, but I recognize, you know, that I'm not as young as I used to be, and I'm becoming more and more aware of my age, which I'm totally cool with. But a lot of people aren't. A lot of narcissists aren't, and that's when you see the collapse of their sort of self-constructed personal, I don't know what you want to call it, but they're the house of lies sort of that lives around them. And so I think that going through, you see this in any aging narcissist is what I'm saying. You see they kind of start to fall, almost implode on themselves. And sometimes that's because they lose their looks or because they lose their ability to influence people or whatever it is. Or people, you know, their kids grow up and move out and have families and sometimes go no contact and whatever. But yeah, I guess my point is that when it comes to a narcissistic mother who is used to controlling everything and running the show, losing her ability to do that, I think it's understandable. Not in a, I'm not trying to empathize with the narcissist, but I'm saying I think it's, we can see from the outside that, you know, any sort of dementia or Alzheimer's or cognitive decline could cause some level of anger. And I agree with Dana with what you said about setting your boundaries and not feeling like you necessarily have to be responsible for every single thing, and asking for help. And, you know, a lot of times your insurance company will cover, you know, even adult daycare is a thing. But, you know, they have places and help for people who have Alzheimer's, and you can get help if you know, so start making some phone calls if you feel responsible. But ultimately, you know, again, while I do think it's important to take care of the people in our lives who are decent to us and who treat us with love and respect, I don't think it's so important to take care of people who have abused you for your whole life. You know, I don't think you necessarily have that personal responsibility. Do you have thoughts on that, Dana?
Absolutely. I agree completely. If somebody is hurtful or harmful to you don't need to continue to allow that. And if you have children, if you are married, you owe it to your children and your spouse to not bring that level of chaos into your house. So it's not appropriate to sacrifice the family that you've made to take care of an aging parent who's abusive.
That's right.
So, you know, I think it helps these lines to become more clear when you fully understand. And again, this is a process, it just takes time. You fully understand it's okay for you to say no. It's okay for you to have limits on what you can and can't do. Everybody's limits are going to be different. And you don't need other to turn inward for that validation because there's always going to be people that disagree with the decisions that you make. And so a big part of getting comfortable with the boundaries we set is realizing that and being okay with it if they do disagree, and not needing to talk them into seeing our point of view or into being okay with our decision. If you have three other siblings and everybody's an adult and on their own, and you have this an abusive parent who may or may not have some other existing issue that needs a place to stay, why should it all be on you?
Right.
Right. If all the other siblings are like, well, but you know, mom can't stay here and this can't happen and this can't happen. It's like, well, she can't stay here either. So
right.
End of discussion. Like that's just not going to happen. When you get to that place where you realize you have every right to your, like to your life and to have peace in your life and safety in your life. And if other people don't get that, that's on them. To me, it's the equivalent. It's such an outrageous, inappropriate expectation. It would be along the same lines of somebody saying, I found this wild tiger roaming the streets. I'm concerned about it. I think it should go live with you.
Right. Can you not sleep in your bed?
Right.
Softness.
and your delicious looking little children can play with it. Right? Like, no, it's not even up for debate. You're like, absolutely no way. This is not the right environment for a wild tiger. It needs to go someplace where people know how to interact with wild tigers.
Absolutely.
And like Angie was saying, that's just with personality disorders. When you get personality disorders on top of other major health issues or cognitive issues, you're compounding the things. And it's appropriate to be self-protective of you and the family that you've created.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's something that a lot of us, you know, need to remember, because it is,
yeah,
you've gone through so much already. If you had a toxic parent, your childhood probably wasn't that great. And if you're honest with yourself, your relationship with that person probably hasn't been, well, it's been one-sided, if nothing else, right? It's been all about them and not about you. And I think it's just really, it's really important to focus on, you know, like I always like to think or say or whatever, I believe that when you do grow up and move out and start your own family, or even if you are your own family, you start your own home, that, you know, becomes your, then your parents become your extended family, right? Mm-hmm. They're no longer part of your nuclear family. And so I agree. I think that's really important to focus on what you have built and are building. And I love the tiger analogy. I think that is absolutely ideal here. And on top of that, we have to think about, like, you know, like you said, there are specialists and specialty clinics and homes and all the things, but we can't sacrifice ourselves to that extreme, or our children, like you mentioned, because imagine the damage that can cause. That will definitely continue the toxicity in your own family.
I agree. What you're saying about, you know, the whole leaving the family we were born into, and you know, you become an adult and you create your own family, and that becomes your family, not the family that you were born into. That's such a key point in people that grow up in dysfunctional families. Of course, this isn't a point that's often covered. If anything, it's just you have these unending inappropriate expectations that are just going to continue forever. Your job is to always take care of other siblings or other, nobody ever really grows up and matures and goes out on their own. Whoever's the most responsible one of the family is the one that everybody's going to rely on. And it's the skewed message of that's what family's for,
right?
Or that's what family's about. And, but notice how that mindset, it's a win for everybody except for the one
who's
the adult in the situation. And, you know, so realizing, and I've seen this, and you probably heard this too, Angie, with people saying, oh, I moved back in. My parent who sexually abused me as a child, they were homeless. They got in a car accident. They had some sort of they had no place to go. So I moved them in. And yeah, I mean, I've got a couple kids of my own, but they're my mom, they're my dad. This is what family's for. And this is a great example of the inappropriateness of we cannot sacrifice our own family for parents, especially when we're talking like that kind of dynamic where you've got a parent that's shown to be hurtful or harmful, whether it's sexually, verbally, emotionally, you name it. You can't let that wild tiger into your den. You can't. No, it's
absolutely.
It's, and I, who cares what anybody else says? Because frankly, they're wrong. So like, it's just,
it's true.
It's true.
Yeah. Because it, like, exactly like you said, I mean, and maybe it's not always that they sexually, but even any sort of child abuse situation, whether we're talking physical, verbal, whatever, psychological, you don't want that around you or your children at all for that exact, I mean, you're then sacrificing more than just yourself is what, I mean,
right.
That's a really valid point. This is a point that I think goes right along with this. Amanda from the chat says, how do you handle the pushback to your boundaries? We were talking about, the boundaries required, the firm, very firm boundaries required to deal with a toxic parent in any situation, I think. And I think I would start with, focusing on the fact that they are immovable in a way. So what I mean is, if you say, no, you're not moving back in with me, or you're not moving in with me, I'm not able to take care of you, period. And then 2 days later, they show up on your front door with all their crap. A lot of people would just be like, fine, let them move in. But that's not the answer. The answer is you better leave that stuff outside and make a phone call and have someone pick them up or have them, whatever, move the stuff.
Yeah.
Even in that directive a situation, the minute you let them cross the threshold with all their crap, they're never leaving, and then they have overstepped the boundary. So I think what I have found with boundaries is that it's about getting used to and accepting the fact that it feels uncomfortable to say no sometimes or to set the boundary, but if you can get through that little bit of discomfort, then you're relieved because you haven't moved the person into your house or whatever the boundary is. You know what I'm saying? So get through the few minutes or a few seconds or whatever of anxiety and discomfort that comes with having to set the boundary and maintain the boundary, but don't back down just because they push. Like if they step forward, you don't step back. You stay there and let them run into you if they need to. And I don't mean literally, of course, but I mean, that's what I had happened to me with narcissists in my life is I would say, here's my boundary. And they would go, oh yeah. Well, here, let me come closer. Let me push you. And then I had a choice to make. I had to either step back or leave or fight back. And my answer at that time was just to step back. And that was the wrong answer. And I noticed that when I started to stand firm and set that boundary and not allow that person to knock me over or push me back with their energy or whatever it was that they were coming at me with, then they didn't like that. They got mad and I stood firm and then they're not in my life anymore. So, not that I'm saying everyone wants to go no contact, but goodness gracious, if you're going to do it, that's not a bad way to go by standing up for yourself. But I think, do you have any thoughts on the boundary thing?
To kind of elaborate a little bit on what you said, I agree with you completely that realizing it's going to be awkward setting a boundary because this is new for, it's not because it's we're doing something wrong. It's because this is new. Because
yes.
In a dysfunctional family, there are certain people who just aren't allowed to have boundaries. It tends to be one person's way or no way, and everybody else walks on eggshells around them. And so realizing that you have every right to be self-protective and to say no, but in what Angie was saying is getting over that discomfort of saying no. And I'll add to that, the flip side of it is if you say yes, there's also going to be discomfort.
Indeed.
So there's going to be, thinking that we're going to cave in to spare ourselves the discomfort, we're not, we're just delaying it.
Yep.
And it's going to grow because I thought that was a great example too, Angie, of somebody showing up, parent showing up on your front porch with all their stuff and being like, well, I don't have anywhere to stay. And, take me, right? Like,
right.
You've got to take me in now, kind of a thing. It's like, oh, this is so awkward. I want to say no, but because I don't know what to do. But if you say yes, then you've got to get them out down the road. And it's going to end up that way. So,
yeah. Right. And as Bonnie adds here, she says the grown children, and I think we both know Bonnie's going through it with this one, the grown children get demonized for setting any boundaries with elderly parents, and that's the damn truth. But as Bonnie has learned the hard way, sometimes you just have to let them say what they're going to say. Because people who are demonizing you for this, one of two things is the case. Either they're a flying monkey / fellow narcissist, you know, one of those things, or they don't know what you're going through. They don't know who you're dealing with. They don't understand the depth of the abuse that a narcissistic mother can actually do, you know, the depth of damage they can do. And they don't understand the pervasive manipulation and how painful it can become. So you have to recognize that you're dealing with people who either are very similar to or supportive of the narcissist, or you're dealing with people who don't get it, you know. And so you have to, I guess, decide whose opinion matters the most. And I hope that you decide it yourself.
Yes, yeah. I agree with that. Because the reality is, like I said, like Angie was just saying, everybody's going to have opinions. And a lot of people that are going to have opinions are going to be having those opinions based off of their experiences. And if they've never had a manipulative or abusive parent, they have no idea what they're talking about. None. That's right. And they don't have to live with the consequences. You do. That's right. So this is why it's so important to be able to get grounded enough in yourself that you're like, you know what? This is the decision that I need to make for my safety and my sanity, and for the safety and sanity of my family, my spouse or my significant other and my kids. And this is why, this is the foundation that I'm making this decision on. And it doesn't matter if anybody else agrees with me or not, their opinion is unwanted.
Right. And the fact is, I think if you go to, if you let yourself be overrun for your whole life by narcissists and other toxic people, and or even well-meaning people who don't get it, you know, I mean, I really think that the purpose of life is to find your happy place, but to figure out a way to be happy here. And I think, I mean, on some level, and I think if you can't do that because you have toxic people in your life, you know, regardless of whether they birthed you or adopted you or they, whatever, their responsibility is to you and for 18 years. And then anything that happens beyond that is a choice, in my opinion. And so, you know, you see people who live in their parents' shadow their whole lives, and then they don't ever, when the parent dies, they don't know what to do with themselves. And I think that's irrelevant here, but I guess my point is, when it comes to a narcissistic mother, I mean, I feel like you've spent enough of your life being stifled and controlled. And for me, it took 35 years to get past that point. So, so I think, you know, I wouldn't waste one more minute on.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And you're right. It's so tragic when, you know, you see somebody that has lived their whole life trying to earn their parents' approval or just be accepted or avoid abuse even. And then, especially if that abusive person leaves or dies or something happens, then the other person is just a shell of themselves.
Yes.
The sort of like, they don't know what they like and what they don't like. They don't know how they feel or what they want, because they've always looked to that other controlling person to define them. And, you know, Stephen King, the author, anyway, he struggled with his own stuff in his life. Anyways, he was joking around during one interview, and he was saying something along the lines of a joke having to do with codependency is that right before a codependent dies, somebody else's life flashes before their eyes.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. And I thought that's so true, because it's, and what he means by that, it's when we have that level of excessive emotional reliance on another person, when we're looking outside of ourselves for validation and acceptance, the decisions that we make in our life are not our own. So when we are close to death, we're remembering, oh, here's the college degree that I never really wanted to get, or the partner that I didn't want to marry, or the kids I didn't really want to have, or the car I was talked into buying, or the town I got stuck living in. And it's, none of it is of our making. So I think that's significant to kind of look at, of where are you in your life?
That's a really valid point. Yeah. And you know what, I can, as you're talking, I'm thinking, yeah, there was a time in my life when I looked around at everything in my life and I thought, oh my gosh, none of this was, I thought it was me, but it really wasn't me. You know, it really was, you know, I spent a long time just really trying to get my parents to like me, ironically, a long time. And it wasted too long. But eventually I realized it. And thank goodness 10 years ago, I steered clear. So, yeah. Let me respond to something here really quick. Someone asked, Copperpenny, I think, asks if this will be posted later. Yes, it will. It'll remain live. Okay. Do you have a question for us from the chat, Dana?
Sure. Craig asks, how do you stop cyberbullying and stalking when they will not leave me alone?
That's a good one. I would say start with blocking every single account that comes through that is one of theirs, because I'm guessing they make alternate or additional accounts. You can also try setting your stuff really to very private and having just a few trusted close friends and family members on, you know, your friends list or your contacts list. I know you can do this with social media like Facebook and Instagram, and I guess you can also have protected tweets, but I don't really see the purpose of tweeting then. you know, but yeah, I know you can privatize your accounts and make them even impossible to find in chat, in search, if you choose to. So I would, you know, that's something you can do. You could create a new email address that, you know, they don't know. You could also, just automatically, you know, you can set rules in your, if you use Gmail anyway, you can set, create rules that would take their, any email they send through and just throw it right in the trash, you know, so you'd never have to see it. There are lots of different things that you can do, but I think ultimately it's a matter of, you know, a lot of us don't want to privatize everything because then we can't connect with other people and everything else. So, but I know the blocking feature is functional, but I also know that people tend to make new accounts. And if it's more than one person, it's a whole other ball of wax. Dana, what are your thoughts?
Yes. So kind of like Angie's saying, you know, what we have control over is ourselves. We don't have control over the actions of others. Right. So, you know, blocking what you can, I find it easiest to just leave those accounts open. So they're not on to you, that you've created all new accounts, and then create all new accounts with a completely different name and completely different pictures. Don't befriend the same people. So maybe you just use it for friends or people that they wouldn't, you know, be contacting, and then go into your Facebook privacy settings or different social media privacy settings and just lock everything down.
I did that with my kids when they first started Facebook. I locked their accounts down to the point that they had to send someone a friend request or that person couldn't see their page at all. You know what I mean? Like, so I think that was really helpful. And I think you can do the same thing as Amanda mentions here in chat, block them. As Sky mentions, can you block them? And I know, I think I may have read some of Craig's story from a previous comment or one of these. And I know, I believe Craig told me that it was more than one person in the family or the group, but I'm not entirely sure. So in that case, if you can't block them all, or they're just pouring in on you, I mean, you can also report this stuff, right? So if you have 87,000, you know, false accounts coming at you, report every one of them, because then, you know, they'll investigate and go, why is this one IP address sending out 7,500 different accounts? That's weird, you know, or whatever. So, of course, I'm sure there are other things they can do to hide their IP as well. We know that. But but ultimately, it's exactly what Dana said. It's about what you can control. And so what you can control is blocking, you know, reporting. And I love the suggestion of keeping your old profile up, but then starting a new one to actually use, because she's right. That does take away the, it would throw them off the trail a little bit, Yeah, I think that's really smart and locking down. Yeah, totally. Okay. Oh, Craig says he can't find their pages. So, Craig, let us know. Well, I'm going to scroll down and see if I can see any more comments from you, but let us know if there's something we're missing here or something else we can help with. If you can't find their pages, you should still be able to, whenever they send you a message, you should be able to use like a drop down, like, I don't want to see this, or, I don't want this person to message me or whatever. And if they're publicly doing it, then the same thing, you should be able to use, something next to their name. I don't know what. Let me see if there's anything in here. Did Craig give us any more? I don't think so. Oh. Just couldn't believe. Okay. I think I missed something. All right.
Yeah, I mean, you can only do what you can do. Angie and I both have had our fair share of bullying and just
Yes.
craziness from the internet. There's just a wide range of people out here, and you block those you can. I mean, if it's extreme, then you call the police, and that's all any of us can, just be situationally aware. Turn off your location trackers, these kinds of things, and be as safe as you can. That's it. That's all any of us can do.
Yeah. Craig says he gets bullied on YouTube. And I'm trying to see. They make me feel like I'm not enough. Okay. Oh. Okay. So I'm trying to, well, anyway. Oh gosh, they're telling him to commit suicide.
People will say stuff like this on YouTube. It's really common. Unfortunately, just you can block them.
Yeah.
You can report it and you can block it.
Absolutely. And that's what you should do. And if that's really happening, I mean, people can get legal, there are legal ramifications for saying stuff like that on social
Yeah.
media. So, oh, that's really hard, Craig. I'm so sorry that you're going through that. And as far as the being bullied on YouTube thing, you can literally block anyone you want on YouTube.
Yeah.
I have people come in my comments all the time, not all the time, but on a,
Fairly
semi-regular
regular
basis.
basis.
Yeah, saying mean things. Oh, but Craig says he's reported them, but YouTube doesn't do anything. But you can hide them from yourself. You can use a drop down next to their name, and you can, and it can say, "Hide this user from my channel," or whatever. Or you can say, I think you can even
You
block
can
them.
block.
Yeah,
Yeah.
block them. So,
Yeah.
yeah, okay.
And you don't have to let that kind of stuff in either. I know it can be, it is, it's hurtful, and it can really rock a person to the core of, oh my gosh, this and cause a person to have a really bad day or a really bad week, or if they're at a really low place in their life, it can push them over the edge. But realizing that we don't have to internalize this. We can realize this is a very sick and sad person who's going around just spreading hate, who feels big by pushing other people around on the internet, and their behaviors on them. It's not a reflection of me.
That's right.
Yeah.
And people are saying, isn't cyberbullying a crime? Keep all proof of abuse, et cetera. And that's true. Cyberbullying is a crime, and you should keep all proof because you can. If you know that it's your parents or your whoever, you can take that stuff to the police and they are required to do something. I mean, I don't know that YouTube can do anything personally except for banning their accounts. But I'm pretty sure that keeping proof of abuse is definitely helpful. It's screenshots, things like that. Craig says they hack his phone even. Okay. Yeah, I don't, that's go to your phone provider and make sure there's no stuff on, no spyware or whatever. Definitely change your password if you have an iPhone. I think it's even easier than that. I think there's a way to go into your, well, anyway, I don't have an iPhone,
Yeah.
so all right.
And
Anyway. Go
let's see,
ahead.
BB here makes the comment. He says, you don't have a self when you grow up abused and in a dysfunctional home or family.
That's right.
Yes, and that's one of the big challenges and most important parts with healing from all of this is to rediscover or reinvent that sense of self and to give that sense of self a chance to bloom. Like Angie was saying earlier, she's like, "I gosh, I just didn't know." She didn't know for the longest time. And I struggled with it too, where you're like, I don't really know what I like and what I don't like and what my wants and needs are. And it can be a lot of trial and error. I think it's kind of in a way like developing your own style. At first there tends to kind of be this level of mimicry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when you're a writer, the first, I don't know, I would say probably a couple thousand pages you write tends to be in the style of other writers that you like or that you read a lot of. If you're learning how to paint, it tends to be in the style of other painters or other work that you like. These kinds of things. If you're getting into, modeling or Instagram or whatever, you tend to take pictures that are like other accounts. And it takes a little while to really find your own style and then just get comfortable with it. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is try to experiment and just have fun and stay open to curiosity of, okay, does this resonate with me or does it not? And is this who I am at this point in my life or is it not? And it's just this continual process of unfolding and discovering yourself.
That's right. Absolutely. Do you have a question for us? I saw a question a minute ago. I'm trying to find it now. It was about a narcissistic mother.
Okay. Well, here's a comment.
Okay.
And I'm going to not say this name properly, so I apologize. Ashna says, I don't even know how much abuse is okay to tolerate, especially at work.
How about don't tolerate abuse?
Mm-hmm.
Look, I understand that sometimes you'll have like a boss or a coworker who is kind of snippy and whatever, but you know, there are laws in place for if you go to your, I don't know what the HR, if every, I know not everybody has an HR department, but if you go to your HR department and you say, if there is one, and you use the words hostile work environment, they'll do something. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be important to show, you know, as much evidence as you can, which I know is very difficult when it's just somebody being bitchy to you, pardon my language. I guess I would want to know more about what kind of abuse we were talking about, but I think, even if you don't have an on-site HR department, there are still legal requirements. It could be considered harassment. It could be considered a number of things, but I know a lot of us are worried because, you know, we need our jobs and we can't afford to lose our jobs. And so we feel stuck in those roles. And I think it's just at that point, it becomes about setting boundaries. And then there's the fact that some of us work in no fault states, which means, is it no fault? Right to hire. Mm-hmm. What's it called? I don't know, where they can fire you for no reason. Fire at will. That's it. Or hire at will. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on this, Dana?
I would agree. This also, and I guess it depends on if you live in the United States too. But also setting boundaries. What I'll tell you just from personal experience, my life radically changed when I made one of my new standards that I will not allow myself to stay in an environment where that's perpetually crazy making or confusing or causing me mental anguish. I went through hell when I was in nursing school. It was the most stressful, awful, horrific environment, unsupportive, eating their own young type environment, just awful. And it was so traumatic. And the biggest takeaway from that whole experience was I will never again allow myself to be treated like that. And fast forward about 7 years and I was in a job that I loved. And I had a coworker who just ended up kind of doing this 180 on me and began making my life miserable. And I was crying on Sunday night because I just didn't want to go back to work. The stress was awful. It just was horrific. And I tried everything I talked to my manager about it. I talked to my coworker about it, trying to make the situation work. And finally I realized I've got to leave this job because life is too short to be in a situation like this. And so I did, and I don't regret it. And so one of the lessons I learned from that too was to have an emergency cushion, to have like a good 6 months worth of savings in the bank in case you do need to switch jobs, in case the place that you work hires a new boss who's insane, yeah, you know, or just sadistic, or something happens where you're not forced to stay in a job or a relationship that's making you absolutely miserable.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. And I think that, you know, even if you can only save like a couple dollars a week, start doing it, because it will empower you mm-hmm. in big ways, you know. And I know there have been times in my life when I couldn't have saved two pennies if I tried, okay? Because times got really tough. But you know what? You get through it. And I have learned the very painfully difficult way that, you know, living lean if you need to is far more enjoyable than even, you know, living in a really nice place for you know, next to nothing, because you're putting up with abuse. You know, having the right to enforce your boundaries, even if you live in a one-room apartment, is so much more luxurious than living in a mansion with a control freak jerk. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So something to consider. I have a really good question from Irving here. Mm-hmm. What to expect from narcissistic family members when you leave them? I'll start with this one. Okay. So this is what happened to me. First I got, people saying, not to me directly, but to other people around, because I wasn't talking to them. They were saying, oh, she'll be back. Just wait till Christmas. She'll want those presents and blah, 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 blah. And this is just for attention and blah, 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 blah. So it was a lot of pre-smear, sort of, you know, like, mm-hmm. oh, they know me so well. They know exactly what I'm going to do no matter what, blah, blah, blah. Well, then as time went on, it became narcissistic injury. You know, where it was, poor me, I'm such a victim of my evil daughter, blah, blah, blah. And then it was attacking, personal attacks on me, you know, me directly, or other family members calling me saying, oh, I heard this, I heard that, I heard you threw your mom down the stairs or something like that, which is completely, I mean, the opposite happened when I was younger. I was thrown down the stairs once, but never the other way around. And my point is, you will expect narcissistic rage, narcissistic injury. You will expect a smear campaign. You will expect, just, they need to come up with a reason that you would walk away from their amazing selves, according to them. And so what they're going to do is, instead of acknowledging that they might have any responsibility in your choice to walk away, they will assume it's because you are wrong, crazy, bad, or evil, and they'll tell everyone else that. And you will probably lose other family members as a result of it, unless you already know for sure that the other family members aren't going to be on their side, which mm-hmm. in some cases happens. Unfortunately, it didn't happen in my case. I thought that some of them would be, but then I learned the hard way they were not. So that's what I would say. Dana, thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I don't think I have anything else to add to that. I agree completely.
Right on. All right. Do you have another question for us? Well,
here's a comment from Jack. He says, he noticed that after breaking away from his mom and dad and stepdad, it took him a little while just being himself. And then gradually his interests and traits made themselves known. Yes.
That is so true. Go ahead. Yeah. Do you have some?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, once you're in an environment where you realize, oh, I can just stretch out and kind of, you know, be myself, and then even if you don't know who you are, you'll start, if you're at least in tune with kind of what you enjoy and what you don't enjoy, that's a good start. So you're like, I really do enjoy the old murder mystery shows on PBS, right. But and I really don't enjoy the paranormal scary ghost shows, or I really do enjoy solving puzzles. I really don't enjoy cooking.
Right. That's a really good point.
Yeah. It's just sifting and sorting, and that's a great place to just start. Start there. Yeah.
And I'll tell you something, in the midst of all of this angst and this pain that you're dealing with on, you know, because even going no contact with an abuser is still painful, because you have to let go of the idea that they were what you thought they were, or what you wish they were, or whatever. And so going through that is incredibly painful, but if you take this moment and you, just with me, 1 second, go with me here, and you imagine now I get to reinvent myself or discover myself for the first time, and recognize that you can decide who you want to be. So like if you've always admired artists or you've always admired like lawnmowers, I'm saying that because I hear somebody outside mowing lawn right now, somebody who owns their own lawn mowing company or whatever, then you can do that or you can be that, whether it's a hobby or it's a career or whatever. My point is, whatever it is that you, like Dana said, feel good about, enjoy, you know, lean into it a little bit. I'm saying have fun with it. I'm saying inventing yourself can be kind of an amazing process if you let it. And I think that that's an important place to begin. When it's a silver lining to the narcissistic abuse cloud, as you start to recover, this part can be fun if you let it be. Don't let it feel bad that you don't know. Feel excited about the fact that you get to find out. You know what I'm saying? Something to think about.
Yeah. Here's a comment from Sandy, and I'm not sure what exactly this is in reference to. If it was in reference to me making the comment about you know, not staying in a, refusing to stay in a situation that's perpetually confusing, crazy, making or causing me mental anguish. And the encouragement to have a six months cushion of rent, bills, you know, all of that in the bank and savings. And anyways, she'd made the comment, that's not always practical for many. And I agree. And I also want to add, if this is what your comment is even referring to, I'm not sure, but I want to add that there has been, like, I don't want to make it seem like, oh, I just had so much disposable income that that was somehow easy for me.
Oh, right.
At these points in my life, it wasn't. And I completely get that. But I think if you flip the thinking from, it's not practical to stay in horrific situations. You know, just like if you walked into work every day and had to step on a rusty nail, you know, and you're like, nope, that's it. This is just how this door here works. You'd figure it out. Like you'd figure out a way to find a different job because you're like, I'm not going to get tetanus. I'm not going to, you know, get to the point where I can't walk anymore. My foot's going to rot off because this rusty nail is here. Like that's just not even an option. And if you get to that point where it's not even an option, that you will do whatever you need to do in order to get that extra spare money in the bank, you do that. And it can be done. You know, you don't get your nails done. You don't get your hair done. You don't eat junk food. You don't go out to dinner. You don't, yeah, I mean, you skimp and you scrounge and you save, and it can absolutely be done. I mean, the person I think of the most in this situation was my grandmother. My grandparents were Italian. Now they had to learn English. They came from that old school way of being where the woman didn't work. Well, my grandfather had a low paying job. He worked at a laundry delivering clothes. He got in a hit and run accident by a drunk driver, broke his back. Oof. Hit and run, mind you. Okay, so there was no insurance coverage and there was no government assistance back then. They didn't have support, you know, for children or Medicaid of any kind. Wow. And they were out of luck. And my grandmother had to take a bus, and she had three kids and a husband who was bedridden. Jeez. For about 2 years. And she had to take a bus and work 7 days a week and worked probably 80 hours a week. You know, like she can make it. The rest of us can too. And it's just buckling down and realizing what is actually a necessity in life and what is a want and what is a need. And I just would encourage you to make your sanity a necessity, just as much as your safety. It's top priority, because if our sanity is not intact and we hate our job and you feel like it's making you sick. Yeah. You're bringing that home and you're not able to be this emotionally available parent for your children or for your spouse. It ends up wrecking your marriage. Like it's just, none of this is worth it.
Absolutely.
You know,
100% agree. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important to also recognize, you know, the, like exactly what you said, the older, the more committed you are, the more you make it a need instead of a you know, I
A
wish I
nice
could
to
have
have.
this. Right.
Right. There's never a time. People's, you know, your expenses, for the vast majority of the time, your expenses will expand into the income that you have. So I think there's this idea out there that there's these people that have all this expendable income, and every person that I know that makes a lot of money, they have a lot of bills. And it's wild how people can just burn through a lot of money every month.
It's true.
So it's never a good, never, it's never easy to start saving.
That's
It's
right.
the habit itself is difficult, no matter how much money you make.
Absolutely true. 100%. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see here. I just had one and I lost it. Oh. Blue Moon asks, in general, are most narcissists incapable of changing their viewpoints? And I think that it depends. I think if it's convenient for them, they do. But in general, yeah, I think they struggle to even possibly see the other side of the coin or the possibility that your opinion might be valid or equal to their own, because they lack empathy, they lack the ability to attach normally to other people, etc. So yeah, I would say that in general, I have personally seen them be rigid to the point of their own self-destruction.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Thoughts, Dana?
Yeah, I that's been more of what I've seen is that the rigidity to the, like Angie was saying, rigidity to the point of self-destruction or to the point of ridiculousness, where you're like, no, the sky is blue, and they're like, no, it's not. And you're like, we're not getting anywhere here. You know, you just what facts will it take in order for you to change your opinion? And they won't do it. But
Right.
yeah, I guess I kind of wonder too, like what's underneath that question?
Yeah. That's a good
I
question.
always worry about kind of questions like this that are so specific. And I guess my concern is that the bigger question that's not being asked is, oh, well, if a person does change their viewpoint, does that mean that they're somehow not a narcissist?
Okay, good, good, good. Okay.
Right? Or does that mean that this relationship is somehow workable? This person, I thought my boss was a narcissist, but they actually compromised on this thing, this plan today. So maybe this, you know, I
It's
guess
how it benefits them is the thing. It only, in my
yeah.
opinion, it only their viewpoint changes if it benefits them. So you can't say it's not a narcissist if they can change their viewpoint, in my opinion. Thoughts? Am I wrong?
Yeah, and it's keeping in mind too that it's just it's important to look at the whole, not just parts of the whole.
Yeah.
You know, if they're like rigid and inflexible and like, you know, there's no respect for boundaries and you can't, there's that inability to negotiate or to have kind of open, honest, sincere, solutions-oriented communication, that's the bigger problem. Like, is this person capable of doing, or at least interested, sincerely interested in doing that and moving in that direction? If not, then, you know, it's a problem.
Right. Yep. Hey, do you mind I need to do you mind if we wrap up a couple minutes early? I've got a problem right now I need to deal with. It's not a
Sure.
huge deal. But
Okay.
I can let you finish keep talking and I can come right back. Either way.
How long? Let's see. Well,
I have to pee. It's really bad.
oh.
Do you want me to let you keep talking, I'll be right back? Or
How about you just go run and then we'll start wrapping up here.
okay, all right, okay. I'll be right
Okay.
back.
Oh, you're
okay,
funny.
I know.
Okay.
I'm just gonna stop my video while I do it. Okay, be right back.
Okay. Ah, that was great. Well, let's see. Okay, I'm gonna go. Oh gosh, up in the chat. Here is a comment from Stu who says, "What are the best ways to stop feeling so guilty after saying no to a narcissist?" And you know what? We could even pare that question down to just saying, how do we stop feeling so guilty after saying no? Because I know that there's so many people in here, myself included at times, that struggle with just setting a boundary like that. What can help with that, I think, is realizing that like we were talking about earlier, is you have every right to be self-protective, and saying no is part of being self-protective. It's saying, you know, this nourishes me, this drains me, this is what I can comfortably do, this is past my limit. And once you get grounded enough and realize this is reasonable and appropriate for you to be able to say yes or no, to be able to decide these things for yourself. And saying no to somebody isn't doing something wrong. So the feeling of guilt, by definition, guilt is that uncomfortable emotional sensation we feel when we've done something wrong. Guilt, when it's appropriate, when we've actually done something wrong, if I borrow your car without asking, let's say, for example, or I take $10 out of your purse, that's doing something wrong. I should feel guilty doing that because that's wrong. Guilt in itself is not a bad emotion. It's when it's misplaced and we're feeling guilt, we're feeling bad for doing something that we didn't do wrong. That's when that emotion's misplaced. And so it's okay for you to say no. It's uncomfortable, and that other person might push back and they might have hurt feelings, they might get angry, but that's up to them to kind of self-soothe. It's not up to you to make them feel okay with your boundary.
Truth.
So yes, welcome back.
Thank you, apologize. Oh my goodness, that was craziness.
That was funny.
Happens, you know. I've been trying to drink enough water, and it's just, you know. Anywho, okay.
No, good for you. Good for you.
mostly good. Okay, I feel so much better now, though.
I can, like, yeah. You can fly, right?
I really do. yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for managing that for us.
Yes, there was one comment from Amanda who's
go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just found it. She was hoping that we could give her an answer. She says, I have a question. When I was younger, my mother used to beat me with a belt whenever I did something I wasn't supposed to do. Was she a narcissistic mother?
Okay. So I also was unfortunate I experienced similar treatment, but it was a wooden board. And honestly, I would say this. In our generation, a lot of times parents used corporal punishment, and I don't really know your generation, so I can't assume that. But a lot of the people who were Gen X and above, at least, their parents used corporal punishment and believed in corporal punishment as a normal, healthy thing to do. And until fairly recently in you know, the grand scheme of things, they didn't understand that beating a child was bad. Like, people use the Bible even to be like, oh, spare the rod, spoil the child, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it's not so great. I guess my point is this. Does it mean she was a narcissist? Not necessarily. But did she do it excessively? Did she do it for no reason? Did she do it out of anger? Did she do it? I guess I would need more details. She may have been a narcissist, but she may have just been someone who was a product of her time and her own childhood. So it depends. I personally decided when I was a kid, I remember saying to myself, I don't want my children to ever feel like I feel, to feel about me about how I feel about her, meaning my mother. And that was part of my reason that I don't use any form of physical punishment. I don't believe in it, you know, personally. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just don't personally want that in my life or theirs. And I do think it's wrong when it becomes abuse. I personally don't think there's ever any reason to physically hurt someone to teach them a lesson. In this day and age, we're not animals, and I'm not even saying you should hurt an animal, but I'm saying it makes the one thing I have done to my kids is when they were tiny and they tried to like stick their finger in a light socket or something, I would smack them on their hand, just say, no, don't do that, like that. So it kind of scared them a little bit as you know, 2-year-olds or whatever, because at that age, you can't explain that that's going to kill you. You know what I mean? But outside of that, I think everything is resolvable with other means. So I guess my point is, in some cases, you may have had a parent who issued corporal punishment, but who was not otherwise abusive, and it may have been okay for the time period as far as they knew. And so sometimes when we know better, we do better. But outside of that, Dana, what are your thoughts? Did I lose you? Dana, I can't hear you.
No, I'm here. I'm sorry. Oh, I was muted. I guess the way I look at it is I'm with you, Angie. I just don't think it's okay to raise a hand to a child. Yeah, kind of smacking them on the hand, like if they're going for a light socket, that kind of thing, but then explaining to them. But like you said, if they're, you know, 18 months old, you're not going to have this in-depth conversation with them about why that's bad. But yeah, you, especially using objects to hit a child, is, to me, that's, you're not teaching anything other than to fear your parent. And basically it's like, this is how you teach your kids to hate you. You know, I mean, it's not effective. They don't learn any lessons. They learn to fear their parent. They learn that they're growing up in an environment that they're not safe and secure. You know, no real valuable lessons are learned from that. And I'm really sorry that that happened to you, that you were beat with a belt. It's not okay. And even though society has somewhat normalized certain forms of punishment over the years, it just goes to show that we had a lot of really dysfunctional people steering the ship way back then, when saying that, yeah, this is somehow normal and appropriate, and it's not.
Right.
And it really never was. It's just now that we're starting to see it's just not appropriate. It causes, numerous studies have been done on the damage, you know, laying hands on children causes.
So I agree 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Amanda says her father used to beat her, I guess the mother too. Born in the 70s. I was also born in the 70s, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and Daisy says, I was beaten and told if I cried, I'd be given something to cry about. Yep, me too. I heard that exact same line. That one, and what was the other one? There was another one. And then there was the knock your teeth down. I'm going to knock your teeth down your throat line. We could go over these all day long, but it's not funny.
Right.
It's just
the threats.
Yeah, the threats. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, this has been really, really helpful. Now this, I just want to bring this up. I think this is something that might be able to help some other people, that Mo Cowboy said really quick, because I know we're getting ready to wrap up. Mm-hmm. But he said to Jack, my therapist, and I apologize if you already addressed this. My therapist had me sit in front of an empty chair and see my mother in the chair, then confront her. The dialogue was amazing, her voice in my head. He then gave me permission to tell her to shut up and stay shut up. I then allowed myself to embrace my power. I love that. And mm-hmm. I think that is very powerful. And I think that is something that, you know, that is a version of something that I've done with some of my clients, but not that exactly, but with the reparenting yourself part, you know, with a similar sort of role play anyways, except instead, anyway, it's a long story, but I love that. And I think a lot of us could probably really use a similar practice, even if you just do it yourself, or you just write it in your journal, or you just, you know, tonight before you go to bed, close your eyes and think about it, you know, and you can out loud say the things if you want, or like if you're a nerd like me, you can write it down. I think writing mm-hmm. down is powerful. I really love that, MoCowboy. Thank you for sharing it. Dana, do you have any thoughts about that or anything?
Yeah, well, I think just to add to what you were saying there, you know, approaching these situations now through the lens of an adult. You know, as a child, we're on the receiving end of this. We're powerless. We're stuck in these home environments, a lot of which are just horrific, and you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. And it can take time to truly, like, internally make that shift into I don't want to say an adult. I don't mean this in a condescending way, but like stepping into your power.
Yes.
That's what it is. Being like, oh my gosh, I'm the adult now. Like, I don't have to put up with this. I don't have to put up with this at work. I don't have to put up with this from friends. I don't have to put up with this in a relationship. You have the right as a human being, but especially as an adult, you will not only have the right, but you have the ability to take action
and
to have
the
boundaries.
Responsibility.
And I agree completely. And the responsibility of taking that self-protective action. And so sometimes making that shift of, oh my gosh, it's weird. Like you realize one day, oh my gosh, I have been interacting with my parents through our old dynamic. It was like, our relationship kind of never aged up to where they viewed me as an adult or I viewed myself as an adult. I always viewed myself as their child when they were around and realizing I don't have to listen to this. I don't have to be talked to like this. I don't have to tolerate this. I can set limits and I can be that adult in my life that reparents myself, that gives me what I didn't have growing up. I can give myself safety. I can value my sanity. I can, make certain things a financial priority in my life. Whatever that might, clothes that fit or dental care or whatever it might be, you know, that you don't have to live the way that you were.
That's right. Yeah. I want to address one more comment really quick. Angela Falsetta, hello, by the way, number one. Mm-hmm. She says, we all here were physically abused, I believe, not disciplined. It was supply for them. They got off on it. And as we got older, it got worse and more sadistic. Or am I wrong to assume we all were? And this is what I want to say about that. I do believe that there are people who grew up, who were born in the 70s or the 60s or the 50s or whatever, who did receive physical punishment and that they don't today consider that they were abused back then. They think that's just how it was. And that's because outside of that physical punishment, their parents were otherwise nurturing in various ways, or they knew they were loved. And I don't know that we knew we were loved. And I don't know that, and I think in those cases, those parents did their punishing with a certain amount of discipline on their own behalf. You know, they didn't do it out of anger. They didn't do it. They had rules for it. They, whatever, whatever. You know, my parent claimed to have rules for it, but they only applied when that was convenient for that person, you know. And so I guess my point is, I imagine that many of us were physically abused, but I'm certain that there are people out there who had relatively healthy childhoods back then who then didn't consider spanking or corporal punishment abuse. I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm just saying they don't consider it.
Well, and I think even people that would have considered their being treated that way not okay. I mean, you see this on social media every now and again. Well, my parents hit me with the belt and I turned out okay.
Right.
Right. It's like, well, did you? Because you think it's okay to beat a 5-year-old with a belt.
Ding, ding. Yeah.
So I don't think that. And that's the problem, is it normalizes abuse. Like if you can't handle things, if somebody else were to correct your child or a child like that, or even an adult, they would go to jail for assault.
Yes.
So there's something wrong with our thinking of, well, but if our parents, the ones that we rely on for safety and security, if they touch a child like that, that's somehow okay. That's discipline. Anybody else, it's assault. No, that's faulty thinking. Assault is assault. Like it's just not okay. If you can't get your point, if you need violence to get your point across, then there's something wrong there.
Yeah.
Because it normalizes it. And then people, you know, they're growing up in an environment where they're basically being bullied and abused by their parents. When they do start dating, and if that kind of behavior surfaces in a relationship, they're going to be less inclined to see it as a problem.
Yep.
And they're going to say, oh, well, I was acting up. I somehow deserved it, versus getting the message at home of, no, it is not okay for anybody to lay a hand on you ever.
That's right.
Ever.
And I think that some parents of today are like, I don't do that. I never have done it. The closest I've done is the smack on the hand for the light socket, just to make them not do that so they wouldn't die, because they were too young for verbal expression from me at that point, except for no, you know. But, you know, I absolutely agree with you, and I don't think that physical punishment was ever okay, so please don't misunderstand me. And I think that, again, it's one thing, and I also think there, you know, back then when it was appropriate according to society, I think there's a limit. You know, you will see healthier families, they would stop those sorts of punishments for people who could have a an intel, you know, a who could be reasoned with verbally. Right, or they would stop at age 8 or 10 or whatever, and it was not using a belt or a board or whatever, it was a hand, and it was, you know, and I'm again, it's not necessarily okay, but on the same token, so I guess what I'm saying is society told parents of the, you know, pre-80s, let's say, or pre-90s, I don't know, that it was okay up to a point, and obviously society was wrong. In my opinion. And again, it's always been a personal choice anyway. But you know, I guess going through it as a kid yourself, that's probably why a lot of us choose not to do that to our own kids, maybe. But people get too angry and they take their they exactly what you said, Dana, they literally assault their children. And this has been going on for centuries probably, or longer.
And that's the difference. There's a difference between guidance and correction, right? Or punishment. And you know, there's that whole kind of adage of not punishing a child when we're angry, like not approaching a child when we're angry. And the vast majority of the time, when there is spanking that's done, it's because a parent has reached their threshold with frustration.
Which is the worst possible time for
Yeah,
that.
it's the worst possible time. And we've all been there with kids where you're just like, oh my God, you know, it's you can lose it. It's easy to get to that point. But that's why being the adult, we have to be like, I gotta go in the other room, or I gotta cool down, or I just can't handle this right now, because you know when you're there. And that's just a human, everybody's got their limit. Like it's okay. It's just important to know where yours is so it doesn't get crossed and you lash out, you know?
That's right. And as Daisy says, disciplining a child is different than abusing a child. You know, and I'll tell you something that has been incredibly helpful for me, not that this is all about being a parent, but as a parent, it has been really helpful to me to always ask myself, how is that child feeling in this moment? And to actually care. You know, which is something that, and I was just talking to my child about this the other day. My 12-year-old. The thing is, growing up, I knew for sure that my opinions, my thoughts, my feelings didn't matter. That's what I was taught. And so one of the things that I told myself as I was, you know, growing up is that I'm always going to care how my kids feel. I'm always going to care how they feel, and that I'm going to make sure they know. And that has been a huge benefit to me and them, I think, because it helps, you know, if I know that if I, you know, I never call them names. I never, you know, personally, like I don't insult their core of who they are. You know, if they do something wrong, I'm not like, you're horrible, you're a piece of crap. You know, I'm like, you know, it's not okay that you did this. Let's talk about why. You know, it's whatever. You know what I mean? So I think it's really, really important to consider how they feel and also to care. And I know that sounds dumb, but to actually care, because that if you really do that, if you take the time to think about how is what I'm saying making them feel, or how is how I'm behaving making them feel, it changes the way you react. And I think, and I hope, I'll let you know in a few years, I hope it's the right way, because it seems like it's working really thoroughly with my own kids, and they're doing really well as a maybe partially as a result of that.
Well, I don't think it's dumb at all. I think if anything, we would hope that it would be obvious,
I mean,
right?
yeah,
But
it seems obvious.
it's so not for so many people. And there is that difference between, well, between correcting the behavior, between focusing on the behavior versus focusing on them as an individual. Like what you did was wrong and bad, not you are wrong and bad,
Exactly. That's
right?
right.
And thinking about, okay, is what I'm saying addressing their behavior? And is this coming across in a productive way, or is this coming across as in a shaming way? Because shaming a child, and I see this on social media too, where parents, like under the guise of good parents, like I let my child have it, and I just basically they just shame them. And that's somehow seen as, oh, you know, you're setting them straight kind of thing. And it's like, no, you're not. If you have to destroy the other person in order to win, again, there's something wrong there.
100%.
Yeah, so.
We could talk about this all day long.
Yeah, we could. And I know we're way over. And yes, I apologize for that.
Oh,
So.
no, that's totally okay. Listen, I just want to say this really quick. We should definitely continue this conversation. And we will whether we do it next week or the following week, we will, because I see that there are a lot of people here who need to talk about it, and I think we're a lot of us are on the same page, because we have ex had similar experiences one way or the other. So I would love to tell me right now in the chat if you guys want to continue this conversation in the next couple of weeks, and we'll be happy to do that. Yeah. Dana, thank you. This has been a really good one, and I'm so sorry for my quick exit earlier. But thank you for continuing. I appreciate you. Everyone, thanks for being here. Dana, do you have any final thoughts for everybody today?
Just, I guess you guys, you matter. It's okay for you to have wants and needs and to have boundaries and standards and deal breakers with other people, regardless of who they are.
And I hope that you see it as more than okay, but necessary.
Yes. Thanks,
Yes, big
guys.
hugs and love. Talk to you all soon.
Okay.
Thanks,
See
Dana.
you next week.
See you soon.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. Maybe I'm trying. I'm trying. I'm still in the. Here we go. Okay. Bye-bye.